Operation Interstellar by George O. Smith. Chapter 1. Paul Grayson walked the city street slowly. He was sauntering toward the spaceport, but he was in no hurry. He had allowed himself plenty of time to breathe the fresh spring air, to listen to the myriad of sounds made by his fellow men, and to revel in the grand freedom that being out in the open gave him. Soon enough, he would be breathing canned air, pungent with the odor of compressor oil and the tang of the greenery used to replenish the oxygen, unable to walk freely more than a dozen steps, and unable to see what lies beyond his viewports. Occasionally, his eyes looked along the low southern sky towards Alpha Centauri. Proxima, of course, could not be resolved by the naked eye, much less the stinking little overheated mote that rotated about Proxima, obviously unfit for human life and patently incapable of spawning life of its own. It was Paul Grayson's destination, and would be his home for a few days or a few weeks, depending entirely upon whether things went good or bad. Only during the last 4 out of 2,000 million years of its life had this planet been useful. Man needed a place to stand, not to move the Earth with Archimedes' lever, but to survey the galaxy. Proxima Centauri I was the only planet in the trinary, and as bad as it was useful for a space station. In an hour, Paul Grayson would be locked in a capsule of metal, hurling himself through space toward Proxima I. He was looking forward to 10 days cooped up in a spacecraft of the type furnished by the Bureau of Astrogation to its engineers, which was a far cry from the sumptuous craft run by the Big Brass. His confines would be lined with functional scientific equipment. His air supply would be medically acceptable, but aesthetically horrible, and his vision limited to the cabin, for beyond the viewports would be only the formless, endless, abysmal blackness of absolutely nothing, while the ship mounted into multiples of the speed of light. Then days in a building filled to the dome with power equipment and radio gear, timing mechanisms and recorders, and a refrigerator set up that struggled with the awesome heat poured into Proxima I by its close-by luminary, but which succeeded only in lowering the temperature to the point where the potting compound in the transformers did not run out, where the calibrating resistors would not change their values, where the recording machines would still make a record. And then again more days in the ship before it returned to Earth. Call it 30 days, and understand why Paul Grayson sauntered along, killing time in the fresh air before taking off. Paul grinned. 4 years ago, he had arrived a full hour early, and wasted the hour in the smelly ship instead of filling his lungs with clean, fresh air. Never again. He would arrive a full 5 minutes before check-in time. He heard some radio music, its tones stripped of high frequencies from its passage through the slit of a partially opened window. He sniffed the air and laughed because someone was cooking corned beef and cabbage. Then he was out of range of the radio music. Paul liked music. He hummed a tune as he walked, and then as fancy struck him, he started to sing. It was faint singing. It would not have carried more than a few feet, but it sufficed for Paul. It was a refrain from an early atomic age ballad. Round and round and round go the deuterons. Round and round the magnet swings them. Round and round and round go the deuterons. Smack into target goes the ion beam. Paul stopped his song because the interesting click of high heels on the sidewalk pointed to the approach of someone who might view a cappella singing as an indication of inebriation. She was coming towards him, walking on the same side of the sidewalk. Her step was quick and light, and the slight breeze outlined her frock against her body, revealing, and at the same time concealing, just enough to quicken the pulse and awaken the interest.